Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the result is always positive. This program is dedicated to the exploration of the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight, or listening while at home or at work on your computer, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and where we might be going than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. For the next 3 hours, you will be traveling safely beyond the limits of religious science. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. I do apologize for the late start tonight, but Mother Nature had her own ideas as the rain had our aircraft grounded at Dallas-Fort Worth. But never fear, we are here. Next week, we are going to have as our guest Art Campbell. He is bringing to us the story of the San Augustine UFO crash. Besides that, he is the author of the book UFO Crash at San Augustine, and his website is ufocrashbook.com. As you know, X Squared Radio will always be an open call for any and all pieces of evidence that UFOs are or have visited the Earth, or that aliens have or are interacting with Earth people. This is a show with some excellent evidence and a very talented and skillful guest. Check it out next Sunday at 5 p.m. Eastern here on X Squared Radio. We also want to let you know that very soon you will be able to receive X Squared Radio on your iPod. We will provide you the content, which you can download or you can stream it wirelessly from our site. We're still working through the details and the cost of bringing this to you, but whatever it is, it will be best scientific talk radio on Earth. We also want to put a call out to all POD or PDF authors. That includes Author House, Zulon, or any other self-published author that has a story of space, time, human development, or mystery about ancient civilizations. If you have a story to tell, write us and tell us about it. If we can, we'll give you a forum from which to tell your story and try to get you started in affecting the universe. We will also add our presence to your publication on our online store. We are going to try to do something that has never been done before to help keep people reading and supporting authors, because we need your creations. If you're interested in the X Squared Radio Profit Sharing Program and you fit into our easy guidelines, then drop us a note at xsquaredradio.com. One last thing. Next month, the final work on the Horizon Project will be completed. Yours truly will be featured in the first publication due off the presses in May. I believe the first printing of the DVD is about sold out. As millions of people know already, this is the premier documentary series that has such awesome affiliates as the Sci-Fi Channel, the History Channel, and other syndicated outlets around the country. If you have any curiosity and want to get a copy of the DVD series, you need to go to X Squared Radio and click on the link to the Horizon Project. Well, last week, I promised you a special edition of X Squared Radio. We will open the lines in the first hour tonight. Our number here, toll-free, 888-268-4313. That's 888-268-4313. Our guest tonight is Rodney Clough, the author of Our Hollow Earth. If you haven't read that book, now is the time to do so. And you can get it at Amazon or Barnes & Noble or by clicking the link at X Squared Radio. As if it wasn't enough to write a book that dispels nearly every geological theory about the structure of the Earth, Mr. Clough is the leading figure behind the largest and best-staffed civilian expedition to the North Pole in the history of the world. There is only one theory of Earth structure that is supported, without exception, by all the seismological data, the space observations, and ancient writings. That is that the Earth is hollow. Please welcome with me Rodney Clough. Good evening out there in Utah.
Are you there, Rodney? Yes, I'm here. Nice to be on the station with you.
Oh, excellent. Excellent opportunity here. So I guess I want to start this off with a question, because Rodney and I have traded emails, I guess, for, well, maybe 6 or 7 months about this project, the North Pole Project, and we're somewhat involved in it. I am, anyway. He's leading the thing. But I do have a question. How did you become interested in the idea that the Earth may be hollow?
Well, I'm from Colonia Juarez, Chihuahua, Mexico, and one summer, a few of us colony boys got a job out on a farm in New Mexico that was managed by my uncle's brother. And we went out there, and one evening, the farm manager's son was speaking to some of the boys about a book, The Hollow Earth, by Raymond Bernard. And he mentioned to them that he thought it would be an ideal location for the Lord to hide the lost 10 tribes. So that piqued my interest when I heard about it. And many years later, when I saw an advertisement for the book, I sent for it. And that's when I started my research into whether the Hollow Earth theory has any validity or not. And I've come up with a substantial amount of scientific, scriptural, and historical evidence that supports the theory. And next year we plan to take an expedition into the Arctic to prove it, whether it exists or not.
Well, what other data is there that supports that there might be a hollow Earth?
Well, as I was studying the theory, and I was at Brigham Young University, I was studying geology, and I looked into all the aspects of geology, and some parts of it indicated to me that the Earth is hollow. For example, whenever there's a large earthquake, it causes the earth to ring like a bell.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a bell is hollow, and if the earth was full of molten matter down there, it would dampen those vibrations. And so that was one indication to me that the earth might be hollow. And then I started looking into the seismic waves and how they are propagated through the earth.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying when there's a large earthquake, it's sort of like doing an MRI on the planet.
Exactly.
Ah, and what did that evidence show us?
Well, it's just like a bell is hollow. The earth is hollow. And if you look at the evidence of the seismic waves as they pass through the earth, you find that from the epicenter, on the other side of the earth, there's always a shadow zone where those earthquake waves don't reach. Now, there's two kinds of earthquakes waves. There's the peak waves that shake vertically like a sonic, like sound. And then there's the earthquake waves that are called S waves, that are like when you shake a rope, that they go in like a sine wave.
Ah.
Well, the sine wave, S waves, on the other side of the planet, there's a complete empty space where these waves do not reach. It's a complete dampening of these waves. They don't go through the earth. Passed about 103 degrees from the epicenter. And then on the P wave type of earthquake waves, there's also a shadow zone on the other side of the planet, but there's also it's more like a ring where there is no waves that in that ring, but there are some of them that get past it onto the other side of the Earth.
Well,
as I was studying this, I realized that P waves are more like sound waves that can bend around curves, around corners in your house. You can hear your wife in the other room talking because the waves can bend around. And similarly, the Earth, if it's hollow and it has a shell, they wouldn't be able to go straight through the Earth, but they can bend around it. So that they would be
reflect around it like the inside of a bowl.
And the P waves, although they can reach on the other side of the Earth, there is still a shadow zone on the opposite side of the Earth from the epicenter.
Well, this shadow zone is evidence of
the hollow interior of the planet.
Well, don't geologists see these exceptional waves as they take their readings? What do they make of them?
Well, their make is that the S waves are, since they cannot, S waves can't pass through liquid, they just suppose that the interior of the Earth is full of molten lava, and so it can't go through the molten lava. And the P waves, they have a harder time explaining how they bounce around and are dampened out at the shadow zone. They think that some of them go through the liquid and go through the solid core and then come out in different places on the opposite side of the Earth from the epicenter.
Well, I would think they would know better than that because MRIs don't work that way in the human body. Why would they work that way in the Earth? Why would a vibration stay intact through a liquid layer and then come out of the crust on the other side of the Earth intact? I don't see where they've got to have a lot of exceptions to the rule if they're coming up with that kind of conclusion.
Well, another thing that's interesting is the extraordinary amount of reflections that are received starting right beneath the epicenter, and even farther out, there's a lot of reflections that come back up from the inner surface of the planet, is the way I interpret it. Huh. They just claim it's bouncing off some boundary down there, but why couldn't it be a boundary that ends in space? Now, in about 1975 or there, I met a student that was in the geology course at geography course at ASU, University of Arizona, and he participated in an experiment that was sponsored by the United States Air Force. And I asked him, what were you doing in this experiment? He says, well, we were trying to send ultrasonic beams straight through the Earth. And I asked him, were you able to send any straight through the Earth? And he said, no, they weren't able to send any except at a wide angle. Well, at the wide angle, then they were able to send it through because if the Earth is hollow and there's empty space in the center, then the ultrasonic beam would not be able to pass through that space, that hollow space.
Mm.
But at a wide angle, it would be able to go through the Earth because it would be passing through the shell of the planet.
Well, talking about the hollow Earth, you can't really discuss this subject without discussing the historic flight of Admiral Byrd and his famous detour into the interior of the Earth. When you read that for the first time, what did you make of his testimony and the records, especially the ones released by his son from his diary after his death?
Well, it's interesting that an admiral of the United States Navy was sent into the Arctic and Antarctic so many times, and that he tried to on international radio hookup tell the world what he found, but the government just kept suppressing him and wouldn't let him say what he actually found up there. But well, in 1981, I went to Alaska to check out the Hollow Earth theory, see if I could find any evidence. And I met a fellow up there that was was acquaintance of a close friend of Admiral Byrd. Her name was Sylvia Darvell. And she told my friend John Gagne that the Admiral, after his Arctic flight of 1947, confided in her what he had found up there. That she said that he flew past the ice, came to a continent covered with lush vegetation, even saw a mammoth in the wandering around on the terrain below, and soon they were sighted by flying craft that we have come to call flying saucers. And they took control of his craft, landed him near an inner Earth city up there. They took him in and had an interview with one of their government officials. And they told him that they wanted him to take the message back to our government, and that was that they were opposed to our use of nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm.
We had just blown up a couple of cities in Japan a couple of years before, and they saw this as a threat to their country.
Well, sure, I could see where, especially the underground tests, it's sending radiation in all directions, and if there were, well, this is quite remarkable that he's talking about not only inhabitants, animal inhabitants, but human inhabitants, and a fully formed government with a mission and a message for him to take back to the surface. And
well,
what year was that?
That was 1947. From what I understand, there's a book, a guy that claimed that he heard these transmissions of his flight into the Arctic. It was Amadeo Giannini.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote this book called The Worlds Beyond the Pope in 1959, a few years after that. And he recorded in that book that he listened to. He was on the hookup of the transmissions as Admiral Byrd flew into the Arctic and discovered our Hollow Earth. Of course, his idea was a little bit different. His theory was that we are inside the Hollow Earth. The Admiral Byrd was kind of a weird theory that he had.
Well, it does seem quite remarkable that they would be flying along over seemingly endless miles of ice. And I was stationed in the tropical paradise of Grand Forks, North Dakota for a winter. And that's substantially south of the Arctic Circle. But I do remember it being 70 below zero one night on the flight line. That is a very cold and inhospitable part of our planet. And yet, looking down out of the windows, you're saying that the testimony was that there was lush greenery and wildlife and liquid water. And probably this was not available on the surface of the planet.
Well, you know, anywhere you fly in the Arctic, you can take off from Greenland or Alaska or Sweden or Russia, and you can fly 1,700 miles. It was reported that Admiral Byrd flew beyond the North Pole, and you won't find any place where there is lush vegetation where he could possibly have seen what he saw.
I had one of my listeners wrote me in advance of this program and wanted me to ask you that he believes that commercial airliners fly over the North Pole all the time, and why haven't they looked down and seen this lush greenery or an opening into the center of the Earth? And as far as I know, I've flown to Europe many times and to Japan a couple of times. They don't exactly fly over the North Pole. They fly quite a bit south of that.
That's right. You know, you can't find one single airliner that will take you over the North Pole. That would be, that would be something that they could promote to the world. Just say, take our airline flight to Europe, you know, we're going straight over the North Pole. None of them ever say that. Why?
It's That's because a good question.
They come too close to the opening. They don't want people seeing it.
Well, that's interesting. So now let's see what evidence we have here. Is there any physical evidence on the ground that there may be an opening in the Earth at the North Pole? Has there been any kind of anything blow up out of the center or the interior of the Earth on the ice or in the water or any wildlife that's come out and got caught in the cold? Is there any evidence?
Yes. Some of the early explorers would remark that they would find like logs and live plants floating in the Arctic Ocean. One of them, for example, north of Iceland, found a bean, a tropical bean that they called the Intata bean. It was green. If it had been floating from the tropics all that amount of time it would be necessary to reach into the Arctic, it would have disintegrated.
Sure.
And Admiral Perry, apparently a bird landed on his sleighs, and when he opened up the craw of it, found green grass in it.
Oh, now, wow.
A lot of little things like that. One explorer that went into the Arctic that found an extraordinary amount of evidence that supports the hollow earth theory, and if there's an opening in the Arctic, even though he had no inkling that the earth is hollow or there might be a place up there like that.
I may have read something about that. It seems to me like he was either on dog's lead or he was on some kind of surface equipment, and riding along, he noticed that the surface of the ice had turned red, sort of like red oxide. And upon taking samples, he noticed that it was pollen all over the surface of the ice, and that there were a good sample of frozen bees, honeybees, that had evidently frozen to death on the ice. Well, he's on a dog sled or in some kind of snowplow, 500 miles from the nearest bush, and yet here are honeybees and pollen all over the ice.
Yeah, pollen out on the Arctic Ocean, that would be a pretty unusual find. And actually, that's what he found. He found pollen. It had fallen. It was a smoky red color. It was a reddish color.
Mm-hmm.
And he took it in and he analyzed it and found it was pollen. And where could it have come from up there in the Arctic? It takes flowers that are flowering in a warm climate to produce pollen. Some other things that he noticed also were like the warm wind that came out of the north in the middle of the winter.
A warm wind?
Yes. He measured the temperature. He says that he noticed that the north wind raised the temperature while the south wind lowered it, indicating that warm air was coming out of the north in the winter. And he was... At this time, Fridtjof Nansen was at 79 degrees north latitude, 135 degrees east longitude, and that's pretty close to where I estimate the North Pole opening is located.
Mm. Well, what is the deepest into the crust that we have explored? I know that we drill for oil, but how deep do we actually drill?
I don't think there's any depth of drilling farther than 10 miles or so.
Wow.
Into the shell of the Earth. So how can scientists say for a certainty that the Earth is full of molten lava? if they've only gone down just a few miles.
Well, I've always wondered that myself. I know a little bit about the oil and gas industry, and it has always been surprising to me that even the ocean rigs, and not counting the sea that they drop the steel down through and the casing that they have there, they probably drill down, what, 18,000, 20,000 feet? That's about as far as you can hold steel up without it pulling in two. That's kind of a pinprick for the diameter of the Earth, isn't it?
Oh, it's just a pinprick. Absolutely.
So how far across is the Earth? If we do a little bit of geometry, we can figure it out. It's what, 6?
Well, it's a little bit less than 8,000 miles in diameter. A little bit greater at the equator than at the poles, because the Earth, because of centrifugal force, causes the Earth to bulge more at the equator than at the poles.
Now, the North Pole, I know that the Earth is tilted on its axis, and I know that the magnetic north is not exactly the same as the real north, somewhere around 4 degrees off, and we're tilted something like 23 degrees relative to the sun. But is the North Pole, is it in the middle of an ice field like we see in the movies, or is it in the middle of the ocean, or what is the area that the North Pole might be located? What is it made of?
Yeah, it's an ocean covered with ice, but it's not solid. There's a lot of leads in the ice. There was one trip to the pole, I think, by the Yamal a year or so ago. They got to the pole, and there was open ocean. There was a big hole there in the ice. So, you know, there's not a – it's not a solid ice cap like, say, in Antarctica, where you have 2 miles deep of thick ice. The ice in the Arctic only is about up to 9 meters thick. I think it's on average about 3 meters thick.
Well, I remember reading about an Antarctic drilling project where they drilled into an open area that appeared to be a freshwater underwater sea, and that there was shoreline and everything like that in there, but they did not open the surface. They didn't expose the surface to that cavern. They were afraid of possible microorganism contamination, so they were under orders not to open it up. And as far as I know, there hasn't been anything published about any further sampling or exploration of that area, but that area is almost all controlled by international governments. I doubt very seriously that they would release information to us. Well, I know a little bit about electromagnetism. When we come back, I got to take a little bit of profit center here. When we come back, I want to talk about what it takes to make a magnetic field around a planet, and we'll go into a little bit of detail on that, but just to give me a moment here. We'll take a commercial break, and then we'll play a little musical interlude. You can get yourself a drink of water, and I'll talk to you in about 5 minutes.
Good on.
The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, 2012, and the Harvest of the End Times is now off the presses. It can be purchased at arkofmillionsofyears.com. Make sure you spell that like A-R-K, like Noah's Ark, or by visiting your favorite bookstore. Of course, it will soon be available at Amazon and Barnes & Noble online, but the only place you can get it, an autographed copy of the book, is through the website, or if you come to one of the many book signings that we have around the country. If you have enjoyed Volume 1 of The Ark of Millions of Years, which clearly explains the creation of the Earth, you will need Volume 2 to explain why we are here and where we might be going from here. If you want to know, for instance, where the Ark of the Covenant is being held, or how the Sumerian language was found in Bolivia, or how ancient texts testify that off-worlders visited ancient peoples in South America, then you need to read this book. My co-author, E.J. Clark, and I have, for the first time, uncovered information you have never seen before. There is no doubt that off-worlders have been involved with the development and recovery of mankind after a series of cataclysms. You need to get your copy today at arkofmillionsofyears.com. Have you been to the Discovery Store lately? If you go to X Squared Radio, and put in the Discovery Store sign, you will be amazed at the prices they have on the world's best telescopes. Everyone is excited about star and planet watching. Did you know that most of the comets named in the last 50 years were found by amateurs? Listen, those big publicly funded telescopes have their time bought and paid for. They're not looking for anything new and dangerous. It's up to explorers like you and me. So go to the Discovery Store and get your telescope as soon as you can. Right now, you get free shipping with orders over $75. Who knows? You might save the planet or find the next great comet. Visit the Discovery Store at X Squared Radio. And are you interested in stuff for your space? Well, I just bought a leather hand-tooled map for my office. It's 21st century Europe. It hangs on the wall. It's about 30 inches square, and it has these wood rods at the top and the bottom that help it hold its shape where it hangs on the wall. It looks awesome next to my Egyptian papyrus paintings, and they're on sale right now if you click the Novica link at X Squared Radio. In cooperation with National Geographic, you can find some of the best art and sculpture. Welcome back, Earth Explorers, to X Squared Radio. This is Brooks Agnew, your host, and my guest tonight is Rodney Clough. He's the author of Our Hollow Earth. I do have that title of that book right, don't I?
World's Top Secret, Our Earth is Hollow, is what I call it. It's an e-book. It's available on my website at www.ourhollowearth.com.
There we go.
And it's not available at Amazon.com. I just sell it as an ebook.
Ah, I see. I understand. Okay, so you can get instant delivery of it as an ebook, and we'll provide a link to that to his website on our website at x2-radio.com. Those of you know where X Squared Radio is located on your web dial. I also would like to congratulate my producer. He is actively bringing you AM simulcasts and AM rebroadcasts of this program and other programs, and we're going to continue to grow that throughout the year. Just remember, if it's not mainstream, it's on BBS Radio Network. All right, we were talking about the Hollow Earth, and I was going to ask the question, what generates the magnetic field around the Earth? What makes up our magnetosphere?
A magnetic field, like in a dynamo, is created by a core with an armature and a magnetic field. The armature is actually the core, right?
Uh-huh.
And what is the part?
The stator.
The stator.
Uh-huh.
Okay. You have one part that is revolving, while the other part is stationary. And both of them are solid substances that conduct electricity. So this fits the Hollow Earth theory perfectly, because in the Hollow Earth, you would have a solid shell of the Earth, and in the center, you would have a solid crystal, which is the interior sun. Both of them having electrical charge and electric currents, one rotating at a different rate than the other.
And that's what generates the electromagnetic field around the Earth.
Now, this theory was first brought up by astronomer Edmund Halley in the 1600 or 1700s when he was theorizing about what causes the magnetic field of the Earth. He theorized that the Earth was hollow, had several concentric spheres within this shell of the Earth, and that they rotated about each other at different rates. And his estimate was that it takes about 700 years for the inner mass to rotate once. And so this causes the magnetic field of the Earth to rotate about the Earth very slowly, taking about 700 years. So
that seems like an awfully long time. I would have thought it would have rotated a little higher difference of speed than that. But do all the planets in our solar system have a magnetosphere?
Nearly all of them do. It's interesting, however, that Mercury, who rolls around the sun on its side, has a strong magnetic field, but it has a very slow rotation. And compared to that is Mars, that has a rotation, quite rapid rotation, similar to Earth, yet it doesn't have a magnetic field.
No magnetic field at all.
And this could be in the hollow Earth theory taken care of by the inner sun. Like on Mercury, the inner sun could be rotating quite rapidly, mm-hmm. causing the magnetic field, even though the shell's not rotating very fast. And on Mars, it's got the shell rotating fast, while the inner sun would probably be rotating at the same speed.
Well, I know my knowledge of electric motors and generators, just in building cars for a long time and being a commercial engineer, I have always thought there had to be some kind of dielectric between the core and the permanent magnet on the outside. If there isn't, then the whole thing shorts out. And
oh yeah, sure.
And as far as I know, I can't ever remember a motor that's filled with liquid iron or liquid nickel that would have a magnetosphere. I just can't see it happening. In fact, I think a liquid wouldn't lubricate it at all, but rather would dampen it and keep it from rotating.
Yeah, even our sun, which scientists claim is a gaseous planet, has a very strong magnetic field, and that goes contrary to what their science indicates, because a gaseous planet would be incapable of producing a magnetic field.
Well, we do know from SOHO, the solar satellite that monitors the sun all the time, and from photographs that have been taken from Earth, that the sun does have a solid crust on the surface. There is a morphology that repeats itself as the sun rotates. In about 28 days, the sun makes one revolution, and we see that there is, in fact, a solid surface underneath all of that fusion that goes around. So that would make total sense that there's a solid crust to the sun and that there would be some hollow body or some solid body on the inside of that that's rotating at a different speed that creates these electromagnetic fields on the sun.
Absolutely. Some scientific work done by Michael Mozina, California, analyzed these photographs of the satellites, images of the sun,
mm-hmm.
and he found that there are several layers of the sun. There's a gaseous layer way up high, and then you get closer down to the surface, you get a liquid layer. And then under that, you have a solid layer. And he's got on his website, thesurfaceofthesun.com, you can watch some of these videos. And in one of them, it's interesting, there was an earthquake on the sun, and you can see from the epicenter the waves going out. And they go over like a mountain that stays stationary beneath it. So it looks like a liquid surface of the sun in which these waves occur, but underneath you can see the mountains. And he also has some of these images showing the rotation of the sun, where you can see surface features from the North Pole clear down to the South Pole, all rotating at the same speed. Now, Galileo, when he first looked at the sun and he saw the sunspots, he noticed that they go faster at the equator around the sun than closer to the pole, once closer to the poles. So he, ever since then, scientists have assumed that the sun is a gaseous planet. But these new images from these new satellites, they have taken images of the sun, indicates that the sun has a solid surface. Now, if the sun has a solid surface, that would mean that it would have to be hollow. The reason being is it doesn't have enough mass in the sun to be solid all the way through.
That's true. It's a relatively lightweight star. So you think that other planets, including our sun in the solar system, may also be hollow?
Definitely. I was checking out some of these ideas, and I wanted to check out the gravitational theory to see if this had any indication of hollow planets. And when I did a calculation of all the planets, including Saturn and Jupiter and Neptune and Uranus and the Sun, I assuming that they all have a shell thickness of about 10%, the calculations came out that they would all have solid surfaces, except Saturn. Saturn would have to have about a 5% thickness of its diameter in order to be have a solid surface. But it's interesting how the Cassini images that are coming back from Saturn support the hollow Earth theory. As you can see, images on my website showing the a round circular area at the south pole of Saturn. And so their analysis or their measurement recently of electron beams coming from the North Polar area where there's a strong aurora in the north and south pole of Saturn.
Let's talk a little bit about that aurora, about the aurora that's on the Earth as well.
Scientists claim that auroras are caused by the sun, solar wind from our sun. But this ignores the fact that as the solar wind approaches the planet, it is deflected around the Earth and around any of the planets to have magnetic fields by that magnetic field itself.
Sure.
So it cannot enter into the Earth's magnetosphere. Scientists claim that it somehow enters in at the North Pole and goes down the magnetic field lines and causes the aurora. But in 1981, when I was up in Alaska, we went out north of Fairbanks on the hill north of Fairbanks, and it was getting close to when the sun goes down in the Arctic, and we could see the aurora, and how you could see the streamers going up, causing the blue light of the aurora to be emitted as it goes up. And you could see the rays traveling up into space, not down. Now, anybody that's ever been up and seen the auroras, you can verify with me that the electron stream that causes the aurora does not come from space.
Well, I do know. I've seen satellite photographs or satellite movies of the aurora on the North Pole, not the South Pole. And when this data, this visual data, was correlated with the solar wind was actually at a low ebb. It was somewhere around 300 kilometers a second, which is on the low speed of the solar wind. It can get on upwards of 1,000 kilometers a second. And yet the aurora extended all the way down to probably the center of the United States. But it did look like it was centered around the North Pole. But it looked like it came out from the North Pole, not from the Earth passing through a solar wind and subsequent cosmic radiation causing light in the ionosphere. That's you're exactly right. What I noticed in the space video was exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, in fact, the solar wind that comes from our sun as it approaches Earth is very low in power. It's only just a few electron volts, and yet the when they measure the electron volts of the solar wind that's causing the auroras, they find 10,000 electron volts and sometimes up to 40,000 electron volts causing the light of the auroras. And so, you know, how is the low powered solar wind from our sun going to be jacked up to tremendous powers that they find is needed to create the auroras? When
we do get solar flares, but you know we rate them as A and B and X. And last October we had 9 X class flares in a very short amount of time, and they did emit a tremendous amount of cosmic radiation that affected electronics here on this planet. And I think I remember sometime in November, early November, seeing an aurora go all the way down. I live just outside of Charlotte, although in very dark sky country. And one of my associates lives over in East Tennessee on the other side of the mountain up against the Smokies. And we both recorded the same aurora borealis. And that was in early November of last year. It would lasted for about 25 minutes. So
the Earth, when it generates this magnetic field, it produces what they call the magnetopause. There's a bow shock on the sun side, where as the solar wind approaches the magnetosphere, it lengthens it out away from the sun on the opposite side of the Earth, and so it causes deforms the magnetic field of the Earth somewhat. And since the electron beams that are causing the auroras are following the electromagnetic field lines of the Earth, then when the magnetopause is pushed away from the sun by an extra large solar wind, then it would cause the auroras to be seen farther south. But it never, the solar wind from our sun cannot enter into the magnetosphere of the Earth to cause the auroras. In fact, scientists in the Encyclopedia Britannica said that they had no answer of what could cause the auroras, because they compared it to like a television screen, where you have the electron beam coming out and hitting the screen, mm-hmm. and the screen being like the atmosphere up above the poles where the electron beam hits and creates the aurora lights to be emitted from the atoms of the Earth's atmosphere. But they said, we don't know what is the cathode in this comparison of what would be the power source of this the electron beam that was causing the aurora.
That's pretty interesting.
The hollow Earth gives the complete answer to this, because the inner sun emitting its electron beam through the polar openings follows the magnetic field of the Earth, and as it comes out and hits the atmosphere up above the poles, it causes the auroras to light up.
Well, let's talk about the interior sun for a moment. What I mean, obviously, we don't have any data, but it wouldn't make sense for it to be as bright or powerful as our sun. But you said that the Earth is somewhere close to 8,000 miles thick, and the crust, the outer crust, is how thick, would you say?
Well, there's a book called Etedorpa, and it claims to be a manuscript written by a man that was kidnapped by the Freemasons back in the 1800s, 1827, around there,
mm-hmm.
and was sent, his condemnation was that they threw a body in the lake and claimed it was his, but they took him and actually sent him on an expedition to the Hollow Earth through a communicating caverns. And he was taken into a cavern in Kentucky, which I think was probably a tributary of the Mammoth Cave there.
I've been in it many times.
And they haven't found, like, the end of this Mammoth Cave.
No, yet. No, they've mapped over 100 miles of it, and they have not come to the end of it.
Well, he was taken to the inside of our Hollow Earth through this cavern. And he says in his book that the Earth's shell is about 800 miles thick. Now, I think the gravity evidence indicates that the Earth's shell is thinner towards the equator because of the bulge of the Earth and centrifugal forces probably caused the thinning of the shell towards the equator because if you study gravity, you find out that the closer you go to the pole, you have a greater acceleration of gravity. Now, scientists, they claim it's because you're getting closer to the center of the Earth. The gravity is caused by concentration of mass. So my estimate is that as you go towards the pole, it gets thicker, and as you go towards the equator, the shell gets thinner.
All right, so let's say that on average the crust is 800 miles thick. That's about four times the distance that the space shuttle flies over our planet. The space shuttle flies at about 200 miles up. So if the crust is 800 miles thick, that's a long, long distance. But that leaves quite a lot of distance unaccounted for. If you take both sides, that's 1,600 miles. Somewhere now we've got 6,400 miles unaccounted for.
Right. The Earth is hollow and has an inner sun that is suspended in its hollow by electron emission and also by gravity, both working in contrary to each other.
Now, is the sun is bright like our sun, or is it darker? Or
no, the people that I have accounts of that claim to have gone to the Hollow Earth, they say that the inner sun looks bigger than our sun. It in this I estimate in my book that it's probably about 600 miles in diameter. That you could take a 5-inch disc and hollow it out 25 inches from your eyes, and then that would give you the apparent size of the inner sun being 600 miles in diameter. It would actually be 23 times bigger in apparent size than our outer sun or moon.
Wow. Okay, so the sun never sets in the interior of the Earth?
Well, actually, the inner sun, according to Olaf Jansson, who went up there in 1829 with his father. These were Norwegians that accidentally found the North Pole opening in 1829. He says that the inner sun is divided between its day and night sides. That there is on the night side, there's a darkish smoke color. In the center of that is an opaque circular section that has little openings that look like bright stars shining through. And then on the other side of the sun is like a white, brilliant white cloud, so that it gives, since the interior sun rotates so very slowly and the Earth rotates around it, it gives the effect of night and day because of the separation between night and day parts of the inner sun.
So by his observations, it's a lot less than 700 years for the crust to make a turn around the core of, or the inner sun of the Earth.
You know, I think that originally when the Earth was created, that it was the rotation rate of the inner sun was like 1,000 years to Earth's rotation of the shell around it. Mm-hmm. But apparently it has slowed down since then, and it's about 700 years now, or between 600 and 700 years.
Well, that would be speeding up. If it takes less time to go around, that means that it's going faster instead of slower. If it took 1,000 years, that would be slower than 700 years, but certainly not much slower. So it appears that on the interior, then, that you have a day side of the inside of the crust, and then you have sort of a twilight side of the interior of the crust. One side always has light, and the other side always has a twilight condition, and that rotates around the inside of the crust once every 700 years.
Oh, no. Well, since the interior sun is rotating so very slowly, the rotation of the shell around it gives the same effect as day and night. If Olaf Jensen noticed that their compass pointed towards our South Pole as if it was the North Pole. So as the magnetic field lines of the Earth come out the South Pole, it goes in the north and it goes continually in and out.
I understand. So the crust that we're on, it actually rotates every 24 hours, but the inner sun only rotates once every 700 years.
There you go.
I see. Okay. So the sun
seems to come up in the morning just like it does here because the inner sun is so much bigger, the bright white cloud in the morning starts coming out on the east side of it, and then it goes across the face of it and then goes out around the other side, and you come to the dark side and gives the effect of night.
Magnificent. So the people, well, I assume that there are people, since you've said that they have gone down there and met, that they have governments and everything. They actually live on the inside of the crust, just like the people in China live on the other side of us, on the outside of the crust. They're experiencing the same gravity that we are, because they're attracted by the mass of the crust itself.
You know, scientists in their textbooks, they claim that everywhere inside a hollow planet there would be zero gravity, but people that have been there, like Admiral Byrd, William Morgan of Eddie Dorpa, Olaf Jensen, his father, all these people that have been to the hollow Earth, they claim that their feet were just as solidly implanted upon the inner surface as ours are on the outside surface. So my conclusion is that gravity theory needs to be revised. And my study of gravity, I've concluded that gravity is really different, a little bit different than what the scientists explained to us in college. And that is that gravity is a push from space instead of a pull. It has pretty much the same effect, you know, but on the inner surface, that push is pushing towards the shell of the planet, where the mass of the planet is.
Well, you may be right. I have been reading several book papers on string theory, which later graduated into super string theory, and now we're, as an industry, as a physics industry, we're playing with the concept of quantum foam and different string vibrations that make up subatomic particles. And one of those very unique vibrations is called a graviton. And it appears that a graviton is one of the longer strings, a high energy string, and it has the effect of drawing other strings to it, so that it acts like gravity. It actually pulls in harmony several different vibrations together so that matter can form. And when I say matter, I mean subatomic particles like neutrinos and things like that that make up neutrons and make up protons, and leptons make up electrons. These are all vibrations. And so the fact that the observation that you've made that gravity could be a push instead of a pull, acceleration is acceleration one way or the other. And we may have always, just because we've been, as Newton was, sitting on the grass watching the apples fall from the tree, we assumed that the Earth was pulling the apple to it, which it probably is, but it makes just as much energy sense to say that the apple's being pushed to the Earth.
Yeah, my theory of gravity is that the nucleus of all atoms, in fact, atoms are hollow, and they have an inner sun, and it's a nucleus. And this nucleus, Newton, when he developed his gravity theory, he even assumed that, like the scientists of his day, that all of space is filled full of this etheric substance.
Right.
That's an ether gas. And, it accelerates into the Earth because, in my theory, this nucleus of the atom is gathering this etheric gas or substance and concentrating it down into a smaller physical gyroscopic particle, which is then ejected outside the south pole opening of the atom, and then it rotates in the magnetic field of the atom. And when the atom concentrates this ether down into this gyroscopic particle that takes up less space, it produces a vacuum in the nucleus of the atom in the ether field, in the ether of space.
Mm-hmm.
And so as the ether of space always abhors a vacuum, it rushes in to fill that vacuum, and as it rushes in, it exerts a pressure on everything it passes through. So wherever you have a large concentration of mass, you're going to have lots of nucleus of atoms creating vacuum in the ether. And that causes the ether to rush in from space and exerts a pressure on all of us. So we're actually being pressed down to the surface of the planet rather than pulled.
Well, that's an interesting theory. I know as a physicist, one of the things that we're always searching for is a theory of everything, because although Newton's theories of gravity work wonderfully for planets, they mathematically do not work out when we talk about a quantum level. So we have been searching for a solution to quantum gravity, and hence superstring theory is kind of the most popular, because it works all the math formulas and it seems to function correctly, and it seems to be repeatable. Gravity is by far the weakest force in the universe. We don't understand everything about gravity, but it's awfully hard to deny it. When I jump up, I always come down.
Yeah, mentioning quantum, these gyroscopic particles, in my theory, as they are formed in the nucleus of the atoms from this ether and ejected out into the magnetic field of the atom, well, we know that atoms are always being continually bombarded by other particles, and as these particles go down through the magnetic field, it causes these gyroscopic particles to be knocked out of the magnetic field. And since they go down through one layer of gyroscopic particles and then through another layer and down through another, these gyroscopic particles are knocked out in layers. So you have a little bunch of gyroscopic particles flying through space, and then behind them comes another. So that gives you the frequency of light and heat. And since atoms are continually losing these gyroscopic particles in the form of heat and light and radio waves, they have to be replaced. And so they're replaced by the nucleus, creating more of them out of the ether of space. So I think this perfectly explains how inside the Earth we can have a gravity that's holding the interior inhabitants with their feet implanted on the inner surface, because as the ether rushes into the shell of the planet from the hollow interior, it was a push on them towards the inner surface.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the inner sun. What we know, the frequencies that are generated by our sun and most of the radiation that comes from the sun in the form of UV, just alone, the UV, not counting the cosmic radiation, life could not be sustained on the surface of this planet without the magnetosphere and the ionosphere protecting us here on this planet. Those of us that go to tanning salons, you'll notice that those fluorescent tubes that are inside that tanning bed, they have a couple of drops of mercury on the inside, and they shoot a high voltage shot through that, which takes that drop of mercury and turns it into a plasma gas, which conducts electricity. It takes about between 40 and 70 watts to keep that that mercury in gaseous form, but the wavelength that it puts off is about 254 nanometers, which is germicidal, and it would kill you if you were exposed to it. But they put a dope on the inside of the glass, which fluoresces at a different frequency, somewhere around 360 nanometers, and that's what tans you. That's called UVB rays. So Mr. Clef is exactly correct that as these molecules are bombarded with one frequency, they give off another frequency, and that's constantly replaced by the voltage that you're pouring through the bulb. And the same thing happens in nature. We have a spectrum of protons. Hydrogen is about the heaviest proton that we have, and it goes all down to about iron, which is sort of the apex of the curve, and then they slowly build molecular weight back out, or atomic weight, as we go back out on the periodic chart. And that's what makes a hydrogen bomb work, is we fuse two hydrogen protons together, and they lose a little bit of mass to become helium protons. And that mass multiplied times the speed of light squared is the explosion that you see. That's the energy that allows the thing to be self-perpetuating. That's where the chain reaction comes from, is these protons lose mass. So
and that mass that they lose is these gyroscopic particles, in my theory, that are created by the nucleus of the atom that generates the magnetic field of the Earth. So that the magnetic field, the mass that caused the magnetic field, is where all that energy is coming from.
Well, that's highly interesting. So the sun that's on the inside of the Earth has got to be putting off longer wavelengths, that is to say, less frequency radiation than what our sun is, because there's no magnetosphere to protect the people on the inside of the planet. So it would be a sterile environment unless the sun was somewhat cooler than our sun is.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Olaf Jansen reported that the inner sun puts a electrical ion charge in the air that gives everything lots of energy. He says he never felt better in his whole life than when the time that he lived in the hollow Earth. Everything grows to tremendous sizes. Trees grow to 1,000 feet tall. The mammoths that he saw there were up to 75 feet tall, 120 feet long.
Oh my goodness. That's
turtles were 7 feet tall, 20 feet long, apples as big as your head, and grapes as big as peaches.
I was going to ask you, actually it was relayed to me by one of my listeners, do people on the interior of the Earth live longer than people on the surface of the Earth?
Oh yes, that's the one thing that he reported. Yes, they live between 300 and 800 years long, and perhaps even longer, because of the ideal conditions within the Earth. He says that the people of inner Earth claim that this Earth was created for the world within, and the people and the life that's on the exterior of the planet is like the lichen that grows on the outside of your house. So the world was really created for the within world. And he claimed that their capital city is built around the original Garden of Eden on this mountain plateau of the inner continent.
How would you say, how would a hollow Earth form in space? Let's just assume for a moment that for part of the temporal universe, and in our book, The Arc of Millions of Years, we make a difference between the temporal and spiritual universes. But in the temporal universe, when planets are formed, is it natural for a hollow planet to form?
Well, looking out in space, you find a lot of planetary nebulas where you have a star in the center and a, like a hollow section, and then around that like a shell.
Mm-hmm.
And look, there's a lot of things in nature that seem to be built around this formation pattern. For example, geodes are from molten lava, or however they form. You break them open and you find a hollow core.
Right.
Well, the Earth, from the studies that I got from William Morgan in his book at Adorpa, he went to the inner Earth. He said that this Earth has a spirit world. It and that the spirit world was the foundation of this Earth, and the physical matter was like space dust and rocks that settled on this spirit hollow planet. And as it settled onto it, then it assumed the same shape as the spirit world was. And as matter rotates in a rotating plane, it throws matter away from the center by centrifugal force.
Mm-hmm.
So so matter settling on this spiritual globe would leave a hollow in the center of the planet, and the gravity falling onto the matter that it accumulates on this spiritual bubble would also tend to solidify the planet. And then when water was then placed upon the planet, there were reactions of chemical reactions that caused the lava flows, the volcanoes, and there is no interior lava inside the planet. This can all be explained, and volcanic actions can be explained by the reaction of water with original space dust and metals. For example, if you bring water in contact with sodium,
right,
or phosphorus,
sodium,
or sulfur, you have spontaneous combustion.
That's true.
So the Earth, when studying tectonics, realized that the Earth has these plates called tectonic plates, and the location of the most voluminous extrusion of lava on this planet is at the plate boundaries. But exactly where the most lava is coming out of the Earth is where all the greatest frequency of earthquakes are happening. So how do you have earthquakes occurring exactly where it's supposed to be most liquid?
Well, you know, you just kind of aroused my faculties there too, because these tectonic plates are constantly being pushed apart. A good example is the triangle of Afar in southern Africa. Last September, there was a geological team that flew there in a helicopter, and they landed, and no sooner did they land, but the ground began to shake beneath their feet. The ground began to rip open like a zipper, and the pilot yelled for them to get back into the helicopter, which they did. And as they took off, they watched the ground rip open before their very eyes. And between then, just last September and now, that whole area has sunk over 110 meters, and it is going to fill in with the Red Sea. Now, I'm not saying that we are prophets or anything, but we predicted this in the arc of millions of years, that this kind of activity would happen, and we specifically mentioned the Triangle of Afar in Africa, and now it's happening right before our eyes. So, actually, it supports the hollow Earth theory because the crust is continuously expanding.
And the interaction of the gravitational fields of the moon, the sun, and the earth causes the earth's shell to expand and contract. And the plate boundaries are always grinding against each other. You know, it opens up cracks farther down into the earth, and water seeps down into there, and they seep down into deposits of original space, pure space dust and rocks, metals like sodium, phosphorus, and sulfur, and it causes combustion, spontaneous combustion. That's what's creating these the volcanic reactions with the plate boundaries.
Now you're talking about water seeping down. One of the things that I thought about, and I think you mentioned in your book, the ocean actually goes down into the interior of the earth and around the inside of the crust, just like it does on the surface. What about large, long traveling sea life like whales and life like that? Do they actually travel down into the interior of the earth and around the planet?
Well, it's interesting that, you know, our best fishing on this planet is up in the Arctic, up in Alaska, northern Atlantic Ocean. Every year those fish come down from the Arctic, from the interior of the earth, and they fill our nets, keeping our fisheries really active. A lot of that fish comes from the interior of the earth. I'm sure that there's a lot that goes there too, including birds.
Well, that's highly interesting. Now, as we approach our final hour, we're going to be talking about the expedition in July of 2007 that you have put together, your plans to put that together, and what struggles you've had in putting it together. And also, we're going to talk about the expedition company and the crew that we're putting together and what kind of skill sets we're going to have. There's going to be a lot of interesting stuff. You definitely do not want to miss this last hour. But I wanted to cover a couple more questions about hollow earth structure, and that way we'll have this all done. And when people play this back, we have people all over the world that listen to this program at all hours of the day. Some people just go to work, open up BBS Radio, they go to X Squared Radio, and they open up the archives and they listen to this program, and we get mail from all over the world. Do you think, let's see here, how do I want to say this? We've said that there are other hollow planets in our solar system, and this Earth being peopled with mankind for, well, recent history, we know of about 6,000 or 7,000 years, but we also have evidence of civilizations that lived 13,000 years ago, 25,000 years ago, and we have some evidence that sentient, organized, governmental-led peoples were here as far as 200,000 years ago. Many of these races completely disappeared off the face of the earth, not the least of which, we're going to talk about the Lost Ten Tribes in a little bit, but we've lost the Atlanteans, we've lost the Lemurians, we've lost the Mayans, the Aztecs, the Toltecs, huge civilizations, highly advanced with astronomy and medicine and engineering and water purification, domestication of animals, agriculture, highly advanced people, just completely disappear off the surface of the planet. Do you think that they may have found a way to get off the volatile surface of the planet and reach the interior calm of the planet Earth?
I don't know if you've ever seen this movie put out by Disney called Island at the Top of the World, but it's about the Vikings that settled in Greenland around 900 A.D. They came from Iceland and they settled on the west coast and a couple of colonies there. And sometime before Europeans recolonized Greenland in the 1721 or thereabouts, this Viking colony just disappeared. And there are several authors that have written about wondering, speculating of what happened to them. But it's interesting that Admiral Perry's physicist, Lieutenant Green, on his way to the pole, and in some of his activities up there, he happened to ask the Greenland Eskimos what happened to the Vikings that used to live on their island. And they said that every year they would go farther and farther north. They would find more plentiful hunting towards the north. Until one winter, the hunting party just came back and told the rest of them that they had found a paradise out there in the Arctic Ocean.
Really?
And the Eskimos just said that they just all picked up their bags and their things, and they left their animals, but they just all trudged off across the ice singing songs, and they never did come back. Now, the Eskimos themselves believe that there's a hole in the Arctic Ocean. And then in the same direction that these Eskimos traced off across the ice, which is northwest of the of Greenland's trek to the pole, in the area where I estimate the North Pole opening is located, at 84.4 north latitude, 141 east longitude, is where these Eskimos says these Vikings went. Now, there's so legends that from our ancestors, I can trace my ancestry back to England, back to Normandy, to the Vikings that settled Normandy, France, and they came from northern Germany. They were called the Anglo-Saxons when they eventually got to England. But everywhere they migrated, they would bury their dead in mounds of dirt. And then the Russian archaeologists, before the Bolshevik Revolution, dug into some of these mounds and found some genealogies that showed that these people were of the lost 10 tribes, that they had been captured by the Syrians 721 B.C., and then eventually escaped from them up over the Caucasus Mountains. And that's why a lot of us are Caucasians, because we're descendants of the lost tribes of Israel. But there's a group of them. Legend is, Olaf Jensen was remarking to his father before they found the pole opening that their legends are that their ancestors, the Vikings, a large group of them, went into the north into a chosen land. And he called them the chosen people. And he believed that they were their relatives. And when they actually got to the inner surface of the planet and met these people, they said that their God was Jehovah. The God, Jehovah is the God of the ancient Israelites. So my conclusion is that these people of the inner earth are Vikings, or descendants of the Lost Ten Tribes, and perhaps others.
Well, I know when we talk about how the Vikings were looked at by the Romans and by the Hittites, and they used to remark that they were tall and their skin was white and they had muscles and they wore metal bands around their neck and they would wash their hair and lye so that it would stick up real thick and large, and they were almost impossible to fight because they were so powerful and so tall and had such incredible stamina. And they were obviously not of the same genetic lineage of the people of the Middle East or Southern Europe. But one of the things I wanted to bring up right before the end of the hour, I've read a lot of Jay Lambrecht's work, and I'm fascinated by his treatment of a lot of the seismic data that you mentioned, shadow waves and P waves. All these kinds of anomalies that we see in regular seismic data that science doesn't know how to explain, but Jay Lambrecht's models match this data perfectly. They just work with it nicely. I do have an indication we have a caller on the line. Caller, where are you calling from?
Hello, Brooks.
Yes.
This is Gary Larson, Utah.
Yes, how are you, sir?
Good. I tried you last week, and we didn't have a good connection. Do you remember?
Well, now we learned how to handle telephone calls.
Well, we've got a good connection now. I just need to have my wife turn down the radio a little bit in there. But you can hear me okay?
Oh, yes. We can hear you fine. Rodney, can you hear Mr. Larson?
Yeah, I can hear him, but not quite as well as you, probably.
Okay.
What's your question for us
tonight? Just 1 second. Tom, turn that radio down. Okay, here we go. I just got a couple of comments and a question.
Okay.
I was in the Navy many, many years ago, and electronic technician, aviation, and one of the questions that that I have has to do with one of the things that we had, of course, was for measuring metal, measuring anti-sub warfare, was measuring the lines of flux from the magnetic earth as it is warped or bent by metal. And if you know what I mean, that was one of the ways they had of detecting submarines.
Right. I would think that the body of a submarine would interrupt the magnetic fields of the earth. And you
right.
might want to speak up just a little bit.
Okay. So here's what I'm getting at. Because a magnet, which we can consider the Earth as a magnet, it'll have lines of flux coming from one pole to the other, not only on the exterior, but it has to go through the interior also.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, if there's all this activity going on, and if we have governments, we can assume that there's probably vehicles and all kinds of activity on the inside. It seems like we would be detecting, if we have equipment that's detecting submarines or metallic objects here on the top, it seems like what's going on inside would be causing, deviations that we'd be detecting also.
Well, we discussed earlier that the crust may be as thick as 800 miles. Do you think that these detection devices would work through 800 miles of solid rock?
I'm wondering if it depends on if a line of flux is a continuing line that is felt in a completeness all the way around or not.
Well, we know in physics, and we've proven this many, many times, that flux lines do not break. They are continuous.
Okay. Okay. Well, yeah, that's kind of a stupid question, maybe, but it was just a thought that I had. Now, what about, when we're talking, you were talking about on the inside, gravity, we would actually be standing kind of upside down to what we are now.
So well, maybe we're standing upside down.
What's that?
Maybe we're standing upside down, and they're standing right side up on the inside of the core.
The point is, as you go on your adventure into the Earth, at some point, you're going to be moving from one, make it 180 degree turn in your balance in order to maintain your position of upright, aren't
well,
you?
Well, we're going to discuss that exactly in detail because this is going to be one amazing expedition. And I feel exactly like you do that, at some point you're going to have to make a U-turn. But I think it's going to be pretty gradual, a lot more gradual than people think, and maybe that's why it hasn't been openly discovered before. It's not quite like a pre-Columbian world, or Columbus world, where we're sailing off the edge of a flat planet, but we'll see what it's going to be like. Listen, thank you very much for the call. We're going to take a short commercial break, and we will be back. Do about two or three commercials here, and then we'll take a short musical interlude. Let Mr. Clough get a glass of water, and me too.
Okay.
And thank you very much for calling.
You bet.
Have you bought inkjet cartridges for your printer lately? Man, I paid about $80 to replace the color and black cartridges at a national retail store that will remain unnamed. Well, no more. Now I do all my inkjet shopping at 123 Inkjets. I bought a color cartridge for less than $20. I got free shipping, and I got a chance at winning a free printer. Forget about those high prices for inkjet cartridges. Click on the 123 inkjet sign at X Squared Radio and start saving money. Right now, the incredible March Madness sale is in full swing. And don't forget to check out their other printer supplies. That's 123 inkjet at X Squared Radio. With only a few missions left, this space shuttle fleet will soon be decommissioned. This spacecraft has carried the entire planet into the next millennia, with dozens of satellites, probes, and countless numbers of experiments. It has inspired us all. I never got to go to Florida and watch a launch. I always wanted to, but I was always too busy, just like you are. That's why I like to shop at the Space Store. I have a model of the Space Shuttle Orbiter that's over 25 inches tall in my library. Visitors always stop by and comment how fantastic the detail is. I want to keep the memory of this great program alive because it represents the best efforts of the human race. And you can, too, by clicking the Space Store sign at X Squared Radio. They have great stuff for kids of all sizes, even ones big as me. Now, if you got a birthday or holiday coming up, you need to visit the Space Store at X Squared Radio. They've got things at all ranges of prices. Who knows? You just might inspire the next generation of space explorers. And one more thing. We know from our emails here at X Squared Radio that there are many listeners out there in the business of education. Well, without your hard work and dedication to the students of the world, there would be no scientists. We would have no space program, no cures for disease, no new research into cleaner sources of energy. That's why we at X Squared Radio are proud to welcome our new affiliate, the Academic Superstore. They have every supply that teachers, professors, and researchers might need at rock-bottom prices. They got software like AutoCAD, Minitab, Dreamweaver, and all kinds of general software at huge educational discounts. They also have those neat gadgets, iPod accessories, and models that make educating fun and help students grasp those concepts at the edge of their current imagination. Please visit the Academic Superstore at X Squared Radio. And we will take a very short musical break. We'll be right back with more of our guest, Rodney Clough, and the Hollow Earth Theory. Welcome back, Earth Explorers, to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. Our guest tonight, Rodney Clough, author, teacher, lecturer, just an amazing individual. And he is leading, has inspired a group, and is leading an expedition in July of 2007 to the Hollow Earth. Now, I want to know, Rodney, how many people can join the expedition and what skill sets have you acquired so far on the team?
Well, back in 2003, Steve Curry of the expedition company at Provo, Utah contacted me. He had just made an expedition down the Tsongkhapa Gorge in Tibet in which his guides pointed out to him a hidden falls behind which they said was a cavern that goes to Agartha, which is their name for Hollow Earth. they claimed that many years ago, the king of the inner world came out through this cavern and promised that their people, that someday their people would emerge from inner earth to help establish world peace. Well, Steve, interested in a hollow earth theory, from this, contact in Tibet, searched the internet, found my website. He contacted me and, said that his father many years ago had read the Hollow Earth book and wanted to go up to the North Pole and see if he could find that pole opening. And they started up his expedition company and never did go up there, but they made a successful expedition company. Steve wanted to know if I could help him put on an expedition and go up there and see if we could find that polar opening and prove if the Earth is, hollow Earth theory is really true or not. So, we went up to Utah and we met with, Steve. I'm actually from here in Arizona, Sun City. And, we met with him and we put together this expedition. Our plan is that, next summer, of 2007, we would leave from Murmansk, Russia, and go to the North Pole and then south on the 141st meridian and look for this opening into the hollow earth that the Vikings found and the lost tribes supposedly went through to the inner earth. Now, we have room enough for 108 people on our ship, but so far, we've got about 40 people, and we're looking for another 25 or so people that can join us on this historic adventure.
Now, what kind of skill sets have you acquired so far for the expedition with the 40 people?
Well, we have several different kinds of people that have joined our expedition, but, Dr. Agnew, Steve Curry is our expedition organizer,
mm-hmm.
and he has control of the count of the contacts.
Ah, okay.
My job has been just to do the marketing and to drive up interested people to his website to sign up for the expedition.
Okay.
Few of the expedition members, but I don't know them all.
What is his website?
It is his expedition website is it's easiest to get to it from his Hollow Earth website. It's voyagehollowearth.com, and then you click on that where it says his expedition company.
Okay. VoyageHollowEarth.com. We'll put a link on X Squared Radio for that. And so what kind of skill sets would you hope to acquire? I mean, obviously, you want people that can take the kind of measurements and collect the kind of data that we can bring back and show the world so that, well, we don't have 108 tourists that come back and say, gee, we had a wonderful time with the interior of the Earth, and we don't have any data. So what do you hope to bring back?
Well, Steve has has worked with Scott Lindgren, who is one of the most famous explorers in the world today. He went on this expedition down the Tsanpo Gorge with him in Tibet. He is also a film producer. And he has agreed to film our expedition in IMAX format. And so we're going to get a good recording of our trip to the inner Earth. And we would also like to have any interested scientists that would like to accompany us to help us record this historic adventure.
Well, I'll see what I can do to try to attract that as well. We'll put an inquiry form on our website that will allow educators or explorers or scientists, geologists, physicists, astrophysicists, or people with expertise in measuring seawater or ice or marine life, they can know how to join the expedition. And you say Steve Curry's got an expedition company. Tell us a little bit about the company. How long has it been around? What kind of places has he been before?
Steve has taken explorers all over the world, mainly river rafting down different rivers around the world in Russia, China, South America, North America, down the Grand Canyon, down the Snake River. He's had a successful company for 30 years, taking over a quarter million people around the world on expeditions of this sort. The expedition that we're putting on, taking the Yamal, which is a Russian nuclear icebreaker, is the first kind of this type of expedition that he is sponsoring. But Steve has contracted with the Murmansk company to take their state-of-the-art nuclear icebreaker. We hope to leave Murmansk on the 26th of June next 2007. We will go north between the islands of Spitsbergen and Franz Josef Land to the pole, which is about 1,400 miles, and then go south on the 141st meridian to see if we can find the polar opening. We would like to be able to measure the size of the polar opening. My estimate is that it's about 90 miles in diameter, that it gradually curves in from the pole to the neck, about 1,250 some odd miles to the inner surface. I estimate that the inner continent is probably halfway through the opening. And at that point, well, we're hoping to reflect a radar off the opposite side to measure the diameter of it. And once we're inside, if we could reflect a radar off the opposite inner surface of the planet, we could determine the diameter of the hollow and also the thickness of the shell.
Well, this opens up a lot of questions. A lot of people want to know, and I do too. Now, the Yamal, you say it's a nuclear powered icebreaker. Why nuclear powered? Why can't we go in a diesel powered icebreaker?
Well, a few years ago, I think it was in 1994, that a diesel icebreaker followed the Yamal to the pole. The Russians have been taking the Yamal. Taking interested tourists and scientists to the pole for the last 10 or 15 years. And this diesel icebreaker couldn't make it to the pole without the Yamal turning around and breaking him out of the ice, even though he was following him behind the Yamal.
Wow. So just not enough power, not enough fuel.
Yeah, it takes, I think it's about 400 tons a day of fuel. And compared to the Yamal, which is only a few grams of nuclear fuel, in fact, the Yamal has 4 years of range that it could go without refueling.
Well,
so we felt like that it would have a better chance of making it there.
Well, now, the seas that, and I have agreed to go on this expedition, by the way, I should let you know that. And, of course, you can go to X Squared Radio and you can donate to the, Hollow Earth Expedition. And here is my promise. Any and all people that donate to this, expedition will have their names in print in the subsequent book that I will write and publish about the expedition. And I will, do what I can to, get those names emblazoned in the credits with any, documentary that's done. And what is the total cost for the expedition? I know my part to get me there, to build my equipment. I'll tell you in a moment what I'm going to be responsible for measuring. is going to be about $35,000. But what is the cost of the entire expedition?
Our 24-day expedition is priced very reasonably. I compared it to one in which they just went to the North Pole, and per day, ours would have cost $50,000. But Steve is offering places on our expedition starting at $18,950 and up to $34,000 if you want a cabin to yourself.
Right.
So it's on average about $20,000, and he allows you to make payments every 6 months. And to make it easier for you to get your place on the expedition.
I understand. Yeah, I don't care anything about having a cabin to myself. I'll be sleeping with my instruments, I'm sure. But it takes in order. I'm going to take a quadrupole filter. For those of you that know what that instrument is, it's a sort of a down and dirty way of doing HPLC or liquid chromatography. Only this is a gas chromatographic, so it accelerates the particle into a detector and filters it using a scanning frequency, and we'll be looking for certain elements. And also, there's a team that's building a gyroscope, because why do we need a gyroscope, Rodney?
Well, a gyroscope is an instrument that would allow us to locate this polar opening in case we can't see it. And then most likely on our ship, we won't be able to even detect the gradual curvature into the hollow earth unless we have a gyroscope. Now, a gyroscope, what we would have is a horizontal gyroscope. The old type of gyroscope had a spinning wheel, which once you set spinning, it maintains that same orientation in space no matter how the ship goes up or down. So as we would go south, from the North Pole, we would at the North Pole set this gyroscope horizontal with a level to the surface of the ocean. And as we go, south on the 141st meridian, if we are going directly into the polar opening, we will notice that this gyroscope starts to dip up because our ship is actually dipping down into the earth.
More so than the normal curvature of the earth.
Right. So, even if we come within 400 miles of the opening, because we don't know exactly where it is located, we have an estimated location for it based on triangulation of mirages of land seen in that direction all around the Arctic. But say we come within 200 miles of it, and we are going down into the dip, but we all of a sudden we notice that we're starting to go back out because the gyroscope has started dipping back down. Well, at that point, we just turn around, go back to the bottom of the dip, make a right-hand turn, and then if the gyroscope continues to dip up, we know we're going straight through the 90-mile-wide aperture.
Now, for some viewers who have never spent any time on the ocean, they might think that, oh, you'll just be able to see that dip, but from a 6-foot height off sea level, you could only see about 8 miles. Then the curvature of the earth, your line of sight dips away. So you only have, even if you're high up on a ship, maybe 20-mile viewpoint of the earth. So you would not be able to see an 80 or 90-mile subtle change in the curvature of the earth. But I guess this answers Mr. Larson's question. The ship, and all of us on it, we would feel no difference. We'd feel just like we're floating on the ocean as if we were off the coast of California. But the gyroscope would actually make a flip as we went on into the interior of the earth.
Right. And gravity, some people have a question about how gravity would act within this polar opening. Well, according to my theory, gravity is a push from space. So the most of our atmosphere only goes up about 45 miles in the space. So, polar opening being 90 miles, it would be like going up into space 90 miles to get to the other side of it, straight up above you as you're going through it. So So gravity being a push, it pushes everything towards the surface as you're going through the opening.
Well, I'm trying to imagine what this is going to look like, and believe me, I've sat up late at night thinking about this. All right, we'll go a little bit into the future. The Yamal has braved 1,000 miles of the roughest seas in the world, huge icebergs. We've plowed through countless miles of thick ice. We've made it to the coordinates of the theorized opening into the hollow earth. And now we're sailing into the opening, and we look up. We're deep into the opening now, and we look up. This is before we make it through the crust into the actual interior of the earth. We're sailing through the opening. What are we going to see when we look up? We're no longer going to see stars, are we?
Well, that's a curious thing about what Olaf Jensen and his father saw as they were going through the North Pole opening in 1829. They noticed that up above them was this bright star that was always shining in the bright daylight. And he didn't know what it was, didn't know what caused it. But I can tell you, what was causing that was the sun, our sun, shining off the opposite side of the opening, which was above his head as he was going through the polar opening.
I see.
And it was causing this reflection that looked like a real bright star, even in the daylight.
How about that? Well, I can't wait. I think, and you say this is going to be filmed in IMAX?
IMAX format, yes. Scott Lindgren is a film producer, and he knows how to film in this format, so that we hope to be able to put these in IMAX theaters all over the earth when we get back, at least in video.
Wow. So if we make it past all these obstacles, we make it into the opening. Well, I guess I was doing some research about this, and I know that there have been dog sled teams, and there have been even some sailing ships that have tried to find it, but I noticed some photographs of mountain ranges that aren't really there. They're not on the map. They don't show up on radar, but nevertheless, they appear. You can see them in black and white photographs of that area, but there's no mountain ranges. What is the... Is it possible that there are mirages or artificial weather or something that's generated to keep people from discovering this opening?
Yeah, curiously, the warm air that comes up out of the polar opening creates some mirages of land all around the Arctic Ocean. Actually, this air is also ozone free. So if you ever heard of the ozone holes at the poles, well, that's where the ozone holes are coming from. It's from this fresh air coming up out of the polar openings in the springtime that parts the ozone layer above the holes.
I see.
But this warm air also creates mirages. Now, down here in the lower latitudes, if you look down the highway in a hot summer afternoon, you might see a mirage of warm air coming off the highway. And it looks like water because it's reflecting the sky. But in the Arctic, it's just the opposite. This warm air, they call it the inversion, temperature inversion at the poles, because warm air is warmer higher up than down next to the ice. And it's because of this warm air coming up from the interior of the earth through these polar openings, which are located at both the north and south polar areas. And in the Arctic, there have been sightings of mirage of land sighted all the way around the Arctic. Admiral Perry was on Axel Hilberg land. I can't pronounce it, Hayberg or something like that, but it's upon Ellesmere Island in northern Canada, down next to the coast, and he went up one day up on the hill next to the coast and looked out over the Arctic Ocean and saw this big spread of land out there. And he was just amazed. He believed it really existed. And so he even named it Crocker Land, and for some years you could even find it on the maps. Then later, Lieutenant Green, who was one of his fellow explorers, went out with Macmillan out on the ice. And you can read all about this analysis of these mirages in Jan Lamprecht's book, Hollow Planets, from South Africa. You can find a link to his website on my website.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting how they went out over the ice looking for this mirage of land, and it was just always there. They finally turned around and came back, but if it continued on, they would have gone in the pole opening and found the inner continent, which is where that land is. But the warm air coming up out of the pole opening reflects that land inside the pole opening in a what Jan Lamprecht called the double mirage. It's a doubly inverted mirage.
Absolutely.
The first inversion would put the mountain like, if you saw a mountain, it would look like it was upside down. But if it's doubly inverted, and there would be above that another inversion.
Right.
That would make it look upright.
Right side up mountains. And the more they traveled, the more the mountains moved away from them.
Yeah.
They never got any closer.
No. It just continued to look just as far away as when they started. So the Eskimos told them that they thought it was just a myth. And it's probably because the Eskimos were tired of the expedition and wanted to go home.
I have a listener that has sent me a message. It says, he says that, well, let's see here. Do you think that the hollow of the earth is a place where space travelers in their UFOs go to park their craft while they are here? Obviously, they can't land on the surface anywhere and park because they'll get discovered. But maybe the people on the interior of the earth are a little more open-minded and receiving to people from other planets visiting us.
Well, in my research, I was surprised to find that the largest concentration of sightings of UFOs are in the Arctic and in the Antarctic, where hardly any people live. So this would indicate to me that that's where they're coming from or where they're going to. In fact, there was a French UFO researcher that studied the flight patterns of UFOs and found out that the primary flight patterns are in the north and south directions, which would be true if they were coming from the polar openings. So, yeah, I do. There is evidence that perhaps the inner surface of the planet is the origin of the flying saucers seen around the Earth. There are some indications to me that other planets are hollow and that their interiors are inhabited by other civilizations that could be the source of other flying saucers that come from outer space.
Wow. That we could do a whole other show on this. But
you know, NASA's been sending up satellites into space and checking out all the other planets, but, you know, all those planets could be inhabited within. It may be uninhabitable outside, but on the inside, there could be gardens of Eden.
Well, we've covered on this program the fact that every single lunar expedition that we've had, the astronauts have come back with one testimony or another that there were either craft watching them as they were walking around on the moon taking their various samples, or that they received some kind of message one way or another that they were only to gather samples and leave. They weren't to come and stay. And it's kind of interesting that the administration of the United States, maybe in a joint effort with the European Space Exploration Agency, we are going to go back to the moon, and we are going to try to go back there with modern technology. Understand that they may be mining H3 and some other things, but there are plenty of raw materials there to build a meaningful moon base, and certainly cheaper to launch spacecraft into space from the moon than it is from here. But that's a whole other show, too. Now, could it be possible that the inhabitants of the hollow Earth also make expeditions to the surface of the Earth, and that they might be flying in some of these UFOs?
Well, I'm certain that most of these flying saucers that we see around the world are actually from the inner Earth government protecting their land and keeping us from blowing up the planet with nuclear weapons ever since Admiral Byrd was sent back with a message that they are against our use of nuclear weapons. They've been monitoring outer Earth with their flying saucers. Every time we send up a missile into space or a rocket, they're followed by several UFOs. There was one of the expert witnesses on Dr. Greer's DisclosureProject.org that filmed a flying saucer coming down out of space as a missile was sent up over the Pacific Ocean and disabled that missile because it had a dummy nuclear weapon on it. And so there's evidence that these UFO knots are against our use of nuclear weapons. There was another expert witness that says that UFOs shut down their nuclear missile silos.
Yes. I was in the Air Force myself, and I distinctly remember reading about an episode where UFOs actually hovered above a missile silo, preventing a test launch. And I think it got delayed indefinitely because that UFO hung up there at high altitude. We actually sent jets up there to try to run it off, and it just avoided them. It couldn't be shot down, and it wouldn't leave. And they ended up scrubbing the test launch. But I too am against the use of nuclear weapons, and so I guess we feel the same. Which brings me to my next question. Do you think, as we make our way through the opening on a nuclear icebreaker, do you think that we will be welcomed when we enter their world?
We are hoping that they will accept us. We are publishing this all over the world on the internet and radios, that this is a friendly expedition by we, the people of outer Earth. We are not sponsored by any government or any organization. We are just going on a friendly visit to visit our cousins in the North countries.
So you think that they know we're coming?
I'm pretty sure that they know that we're coming. We have a whole Earth contactee in South America that has given us some messages from inner Earth. If we can believe what the messages are saying, they say that we will be welcomed, and they will meet us near the polar opening and guide us in safely to their inner Earth domain.
Well, my wife will be very happy to hear that because at this time she has got a lot of anxiety about me going on this expedition. It's a little bit like me at my age, and I'm in pretty good shape. I still play tennis pretty often, although my good friend out there in Logan humbled me severely the last time I was out there, and he's a little older than I am. But you know, it'd be a little bit like me getting on the space shuttle and going on a 7-day mission around the Earth, and don't think that I would miss that trip in a minute. But this is a little bit like that for her, so she wants to make sure that if we do meet a civilization down there, that they will let us return. And
every indication is that they will. The people that have gone to the Hollow Earth that I have accounts of, and I have about four or five of these, were accepted with open arms. They were very friendly people. They were reported to be that they let any of them come back that they wanted to come. And that's how we have the accounts of their discovery.
You know, one of the things about the Yamal, we've talked about its special capabilities. It's probably the only civilian craft on the face of the Earth that can make this trip.
Well, actually, the Yamal is owned by the Russian government, but it's the Murmansk company is a private company that has been using it with permission of the Russian government. To take tourists to the pole ever since the Soviet Union broke up. And it certainly has enough power in the range. Its track record is impeccable. It's been going to the pole without incident every year for the past 10 or 15 years.
And I noticed by looking at the website, it also has a helicopter on it, and it has another boat in case we need to send for help or look ahead for
for things out on the other side of the fog if we run into it. So I'm excited about that, too.
Oh, yeah, and it has a satellite connection, so we can call back home by satellite phone. We can update our websites. We can communicate back to our loved ones back home to tell them how we're doing.
Great.
At least until we get through the pole opening.
Right. Well, I use the term civilian as opposed to military because I strongly believe, and I've got friends that have retired from the Navy. One in particular, my good friend Kirk Bakoven, has made several trips under the polar caps in submarines, and I believe that government or military vessels have sailed to and maybe even into the polar opening. It's hard to tell. Because they're never going to tell us, are they?
Oh, my. Yeah, this is world top secret. I'm LDS of the Latter-day Saints, and I had an email from a military man that was LDS, and he says that he has several very close friends in the military that have seen the South Pole opening and knows the studies of our government, a military of our government, sending people down into the hollow earth to study the interior of the earth and the civilization that's there.
Do you think they received the same message? Quit playing around with those nukes.
Oh, I'm sure they've been getting that message ever since Admiral Byrd brought back the original one, because they have their flying saucers up in the sky and they are preventing nuclear warfare.
Wow. You know, I get the feeling that we're going to be inner space explorers, and we'll be like 21st century Santa Maria when we land on the shores illuminated by another sun. Have you given any thought for when we return what this might do for, would it be too much for surface dwellers to handle? Don't you think this will kind of it's certainly going to disrupt the geological world, but you know what? I don't really care about that. I think it's going to be quite eye-opening for a lot of people. Have you given much thought to that?
Oh, yes. What we discover on this expedition, if we're successful, it should change this whole world completely. Even the governments and our educational establishments, there are theories that we have on gravity, theories that we have on history, the creation of the earth. Everything is going to be changed because these people that we're visiting in the hollow earth, they're a much older civilization than us in technology advancement. It was only 300 years ago that Galileo looked through his telescope to see that there was moon circling, orbiting Jupiter, and then claimed to the Catholic Church that we weren't the center of the universe. That maybe we're orbiting the sun. Well, you know, the people of the hollow earth have been up there 2,500 years without any, ever since the Lost Tribes went up there, without any disease or sickness. I'm sure that they have the technologies, the flying saucer technology that we see in our, skies. And, what we will learn from them will be just earth-shattering. And as far as what will happen to our outer earth, the scriptures from the Bible and the legends of the Tibetans are that those people will come out from the inner earth to help establish world peace and set up a government of God will bring peace to the world.
Isn't there a prophecy by the Mormon Latter-day Prophet that says that the Lost Ten Tribes will return on a highway of ice out of the north?
Yeah, it mentions a highway. But my interpretation of that highway would probably be an inner-earth monorail train. The Olaf Jensen and all these explorers, even the Admiral Byrd, said that the inner-earth has monorail transportation between their cities. They just put their on these real tall posts, a single rail, and they run their train over it. They could just plant a few of those down through the polar opening, through the Arctic Ocean to the North American continent. And the prophecy is that they will come from the north over this highway and, help establish world peace by setting up a world government that is, that takes into account God and his, way of the way he wants us to live.
Well, it sounds to me like, let me see if I can frame this question. You know, I've had the feeling for a while, and we put it in our second volume, 2012, in the Harvest of the End Times, that I've interviewed so many people. I probably interview 30 or 40 people a week still, asking basically the same questions. And what I find from all people, factory workers, in fact, I was in Juarez yesterday, and I was speaking to some people in Juarez, Mexico, and asked them these very questions. And they all feel as though something very important, very grand, very fulfilling and epic is about to happen. They don't know if it's going to come from outer space or if it's going to be a revelation that comes on this planet, but they all have this feeling that, that something impending, something is about to happen. Not necessarily, you know, cataclysmic and destructive like a comet or a huge earthquake or a gravitational wave from the center of the galaxy, but something that's really going to reshape the secular and religious worlds of this planet. And if that happened, maybe the source of conflict that we're experiencing right now in our world, I mean, basically the wars that are going on in our world right now are religious based. We have one faction that, that wants to annihilate another faction, and we have another faction that believes God is one way and God is another way, and we can't decide on it, so everybody that doesn't believe the way we do must die. And if that was irrefutably put back in its proper place by such an incredibly higher order that, well, as it says in the scriptures, every knee shall bow and every tongue confess, that one way is the way, that we were put here, that we were organized, that our lineage is set up, maybe it would settle all of that. Do you have the feeling that something grand is about to happen that will change the course of human development forever?
It's in the works right now. My research indicates that the international bankers have been the source behind all the wars since the 1700s when Amschel Rothschild set up his central bank in Germany and figured that, that the only way he could collect from the government was to build up an enemy with the interest he made. So all the wars since that time can be traced back to these bankers that they love to incite war because they make money off both sides of the war. And also, it's the way the Amschel Rothschild figured how to repossess the country if they decided not to pay the interest. Now, when his grandson or nephew of his grandson set up the Federal Reserve Bank in 1913, it was set up to bankrupt our country. If money is issued as debt and no money is issued for the interest, so as debt is paid off, money goes out of circulation, so the government ends up being the borrower of last resort just to keep money in circulation. So if they didn't do this, money would go out of circulation as the debt paid off, and we would be back like in the Great Depression where there wasn't any money.
Yeah, I
so,
can see that happening.
These international bankers have set our country up for a bankruptcy, and they plan on replacing that with all the world that they have been building up the interest money to get to here for $1 trillion. And there's going to be another war for independence that we're going to have to fight in this country shortly. And I think it's going to happen soon because just a few years and three, the federal government's accounting office says that the federal government will be going bankrupt in 2009 if we continue on the rate of spending that we're spending right now.
Well, I don't disagree with that. And, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned debt. Somebody's got to hold on to that debt. Somebody's got to finance that debt. And right now, it appears as though China is financing most of the debt of the United States. You know, we talk about a trade deficit. They're turning around with their profits and buying the U.S. debt. And all they would really,
all it would take is for them to unload their debt. And
that's
would
exactly
destroy
right.
Our economy.
All they'd have to do is put their notes on the market to the highest bidder. The price would plunge, and the stock of the United States of America would fall through the floor, just like it does with every other company that does that.
Now, I found a solution to this, and that is the American Liberty Dollar that's produced by a private company, and the money is denominated in gold and silver, just like a Constitution requires. And if enough people would buy gold and trade in their Federal Reserve paper, worthless paper, for value based than silver, we could save our economy from this crash. But it would take, you know, a tremendous amount of people trading in their dollars, so that we could have a currency. A value-based currency to keep our country from going bankrupt.
Well, it most likely
won't happen. There are prophecies. George Washington was visited by an angel at Valley Forge, in which he says this country would go through three great perils. And the first one was the Revolutionary War, and the second, the war between the states, and the last one would be at the end of the age when all the world, he said, back the United States. We would be fighting them on our streets.
It's interesting that you talk about the end of the age. That's also mentioned in the New Testament by Jesus himself. And we explain that very clearly in our book, what the end of the age exactly is. The end of the procession, December 21st, 2012. There's a lot of things that go with that. And, of course, you can read about it in 2012 and Harvest of the End Times by going to thearcofmillionsofyears.com and buying your copy. You can keep up with it. Now, one of the things that I wanted to touch on as we complete our program tonight, you mentioned that, you actually quote ancient and modern prophets, and you also mentioned to say the lost 10 tribes are not on the surface of the planet, but they may, in fact, be safely tucked away in the hollow of the earth. And that we have cousins there. Do you think that, obviously you think science is just now beginning to catch up with things that were well known to the ancients, but do you think maybe we have cousins elsewhere besides this planet?
Well, I met a fellow, really interesting fellow at, UFO conference in 1991 here in Phoenix, Arizona. At the UFO conference, this guy was presenting this book, and he had a model of a flying saucer that he had invented back in the 50s. And he had turned over what he knew about his invention to the federal government. And apparently the government today is now building flying saucers underground. But it's interesting. This fellow, he was taken to the moon in a flying saucer. He was befriended at a very small age by people from Venus. And these people say that they live inside of Venus, that they're far more advanced technologically than we are. And on the other side of the moon was their base, an extraterrestrial base. They landed in this dome, and he met people from all the planets. He says that there were people from Jupiter and Saturn and Mars and all the planets that would come to this base on the far side of the moon. And interesting, just a year or so ago, Dr. Greer came out with his disclosure project.org.
Mm-hmm.
In which one of his expert witnesses from ex-military men or government men, one was a guy that fixed photographic equipment. He went in this base. When it was asked to fix this photographic equipment while he was in the room, the film developer told him that we just got back photos from the far side of the moon, and there's an extraterrestrial base there. That confirms what this fellow, that was a UFO buff from way back, Howard Mender, that he was put down and made fun of by our military people, that they use all this psychological making fun of people who see UFOs to shut them up or make other people believe that they never saw anything.
Yep, we call it the politics of personal destruction. And hopefully when we return in July of 2007, we will have film, we will have water samples, we'll have wildlife samples, we'll have all kinds of testimony and evidence, and not from just tourists, from real scientists that are going on this expedition to the Hollow Earth. We're leaving, you said June of 2007, right?
Right. And, June 26th.
And this is going to be more than almost a month-long expedition, correct?
24 days. That's almost a month, yes.
24 days. So we're going to make our way to Murmansk, Russia. We're going to climb on the Yamal, and we're going to take a very well-planned, very well-organized, well led by the Steve Curry Expedition Company, inspired by Rodney Clough and his many, many years of research. And we're going to bring back the evidence that this earth is hollow, and we're going to change everything. And I don't think any amount of politics of personal destruction is going to stop us. We are dedicated, at least I am, I'm dedicated, I know Rodney's dedicated, to bringing back this evidence once and for all, a civilian effort. The only profits that I'm looking for are from the book that I write, and even those profits will be turned back into trying to teach people and help them grow and help them understand the makings of an operation of this planet. Now, here's the question of questions, Rodney. What do you think, with all of your life experience and your lifelong interest in the hollow hollowness of the Earth, or the fact that the Earth is hollow, and your LDS teachings, you obviously have a great knowledge of the scriptures and ancient writings. What do you think the destiny of this planet is? What do you think the destiny of Earth dwellers is?
It's one of great grandeur for those who decide to follow Jesus Christ. But, you know, on the other end of the spectrum, those who decide not to are going to have the worst hell they ever could imagine. But this earth, I am certain, is hollow, and was hollow when it was created spiritually, and will continue to be hollow when it becomes a celestial planet. And the scientists, they look at the sun, they say it's a gaseous star, and that someday it's going to burn out and maybe explode. God doesn't have any such plans in his regimen. This earth will eventually die, but it will be resurrected, just like we are going to be resurrected by our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. And this earth will become the abode of those who are willing to follow Jesus and keep his commandments.
Well, that does sound like a peaceful paradise. I know that Jesus, in trying to teach his apostles, and I'm not going to go into all the parables and writings and things, but he kind of broke it down pretty easy for all of us. He said, basically, there's two commandments, okay? And what are those two commandments, Rodney?
Those are to love God with all your heart and your neighbor as yourself.
Exactly.
And we certainly aren't loving them by going to war against them and killing them and sending our children off to war and paying for it with blood, sweat, and tears and our taxes just to make the international bankers rich.
Yep, and we're not. Other people don't show it by flying airplanes into buildings and setting off roadside bombs and raping and killing and genocidal war against one tribe against another. I totally agree with you. I think that war is antiquated and we as a people should forsake it forever.
That's the same message we're getting from our interplanetary friends. They say this planet is due for a big change. And that's what the reason is we've invented the atomic weapon. And with that, we can do, analyze ourselves and them.
Yep.
So they've gone on the defensive. And they have, I believe, prevented nuclear war so far. With their advanced technology, the flying saucers, they've intercepted our missiles. One of Dr. Greer's expert witnesses, a military man, says that we sent a nuclear missile to the moon, and it was intercepted by UFOs.
As well as should have been. Well, listen, tonight our guest has been Rodney Clough, and our theme of our program tonight has been the voyage to the hollow Earth. I expect to get a lot of email from this. I do also want you to know that you can become integrally involved with the expedition to the Hollow Earth in two ways. One, you can join the expedition. You need to go to X Squared Radio, follow the link to Rodney Clough's website, our hollowearth.com, and buy his book, of course, and read it. And you can raise your own money or pay your own way, and you can join us and go to the interior of the Earth on the nuclear icebreaker Yamal. Or, if you can't afford that, you can afford a dollar, one or two, and you can donate to it, and you will not donate anonymously. Your names will be included, I will make sure of this, in any publications that come out of X Squared Radio or myself, Brooks Agnew, or my co-author, and we will make sure that your names go down in history as being involved in the greatest expedition ever done on this planet. I am convinced of that. I know you are too, Rodney, and you've spent your life doing it, and I want you to take care of yourself and take care of your family, and I want to make sure that we're successful doing this and we all return home and change this world forever. And I really appreciate you being with us tonight. And we will be in close communication, you and I, over the next few months and years. And we'll have a lot more information on this, won't we?
Yeah. We just scratched the surface on our research of all the planets. Well, if we are successful on this expedition, it will be just earth-shattering. I really look forward to going on this expedition. We're really happy that you decided to join us, Dr. Brooks. And if any of the listeners out there are interested in avoiding the coming wars of complete destruction on the surface of this planet and would like to go to a land of paradise where the Garden of Eden originally was set up by God, on the inner surface of this planet, about 800 miles beneath Independence, Missouri. On this expedition, we invite you to contact Steve Curry, our expedition organizer, at voyagehollowearth.com, or you can call his 800 number. It's 1-800-937-7238. And we would love to have you join us on this expedition. If you can find the funds necessary to pay for your spot on the Yamal.
And that's part of the reason why we have the donation spot on the website, because there may be some people that have money and don't desire to go or can't go, but there are a lot of academics, very excellent researchers, and as you know, most of us scientists, we pick crumbs with the sparrows, so it takes us a long, long time, unless we go to the government and apply for a grant, and I have agreed not to do that. I did talk to the National Science Foundation. I talked to the director of the Polar Expedition Funds, and she told me that this expedition would qualify, but that we would have to submit, or at least I would have to submit, all of my research before and after to the government for review, and I refuse to do that. So I am not applying for a National Science Foundation grant. I am raising the money privately through through the sale of books and through donations, and we will make this expedition happen. I wanted
people, people out there, you need to understand that this is a We the People expedition. We're not financed by any government.
That's correct.
Not any no church, no organization. It's just us, interested people, wanting to know the truth about our earth, that our government, that we paid with our taxes, has kept secret from us, unconstitutionally. They should disclose everything that they know about our earth that they have discovered with our money.
Well, I'm not going to count on them to do that. I'm gonna join Rodney Clough and Steve Curry, and we're going to go on this expedition. And my experience with spectroscopy and people that have gone with me on remote detection expeditions in the frozen Northwest. Well, no, I am quite resourceful when we get into situations where you can't just go down to the local AutoZone, the local Walmart, a local electronics store to buy something. You've got to learn to build it yourself. So we're looking for resourceful people. We're looking for people that have the resources to make this expedition. And I appreciate you being on the program tonight. And we will be back in contact with you soon.
Yeah, one more word. You can be assured, you know, that this Yamal expedition will be very comfortable. They're going to feed us like kings on this expedition. It's going to be like a cruise.
Oh, I was hoping to lose some weight on this cruise.
As much as you want to eat, and it's for 24 days, we're going to have a good time. And, you know, it's not going to be a big hardship. A lot of people may be scared off to go on the next.
Okay.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.